Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's fourth edition of the MHPN and Emerging Mind webinar series on infant and child mental health. And we welcome the 452 of you who have joined in so far and the people who will join us as we go along our webinar tonight, and also to those of you who are joining us through podcast. Welcome, everybody. Really excited to be able to produce tonight's webinar, which is around engaging parents of children approaching adolescence. And I think that's a really topical webinar for many of you out there, both in your professional lives, but also those of you who are parents and raising children who are either approaching or in adolescence themselves. So welcome. And Emerging Minds and MHPN wishes to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay respect to elders past, present and future for the memories, the traditions, the culture and the hopes of Indigenous Australians. So welcome to all. So my name's Dan Moss. I'm the Workforce Development Officer Manager here at Emerging Minds, and it's been my great pleasure to be involved in the three webinars we've had prior to this in our great partnership with MHPN. And we do have another couple of webinars coming up for you this year. Supporting Children's Mental Health After Trauma will be happening early in 2019, so we look forward to bringing that to you. And also we'll be providing you with a webinar on engaging with children and parents with complex needs through a systems approach. And again, that will be happening in the early months of 2019. So please look out for that. Tonight's panel, we're really, really pleased tonight to be able to present Ellie Robinson, who's Executive Manager at Parenting Research Centre, and Dr. Michael Carr-Gregg, who's a psychologist, author, and presenter, and many of you will know and be familiar with Michael's work throughout many years, in particular thinking about children and adolescents' mental health. So, Ellie, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you. Just
thinking about your experience and knowing a little bit about your work, from your extensive research and writing on the experiences of adolescents, tell us about some of the issues they currently face in regard to their mental health.
Thanks, Anne, and thanks very much for having me tonight, and hello to everyone. Over many years, I started working with the Centre for Adolescent Health at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, where I am based today. And over that time, I think I've seen particularly that things like obviously technology, which wasn't a factor when we were younger as much, and how much that's proliferated young people's lives. So particular use of social media, and we'll talk about that a bit in terms of the case of Grace tonight. One of the interesting things about use of social media is that we've also seen that young people are reporting more loneliness as well. So the two don't really match up terribly well. Also, massive amounts of stress that is associated with Year 12. We know from studies at the University of New South Wales that about half of Year 12 students report anxiety levels that are of clinical concern. So certainly school and the school pressure around Year 12 plays a significant role. And also a particular area that I'm interested in is the way that young people are perceived by the community around them. So the way that we interact with young people and the expectations about how difficult it will be to parent a teenager, I think, feed into that whole level of stress and the feeling of not belonging that teenagers have. So I know that my daughter talks about being followed around by the security guard at the local shopping centre without any particular reason. So yeah, we feed into that that feeling that young people have about not belonging and feeling stressed and feeling anxious about the future in the world.
Thanks, Ellie, and once again, really great to have you here tonight. Dr. Michael Carr-Gregg, as I said, many of you will know, be familiar with Michael's work. particularly in the area of working with adolescents. And Michael, from your extensive clinical and research background, can you provide us with some insights of your own in terms of what this kind of, what are the challenges for this generation of adolescents with, as Ellie was talking about, the increased presence of social media in their lives?
Thanks, Dan, and welcome everybody. Look, bottom line is that the research is showing, and my clinical experience is showing, that social media can be quite addictive. Some say it can be as addictive as tobacco and alcohol, and I think it's not unreasonable to say that about 5% of young people that I see are pretty much almost dependent on their social media. The second issue is that young people who spend more than 2 hours a day on social media statistically are much more likely to report poor mental health. And I think this endless diet of idealized images, you know, depicting this, the seeming sort of perfect lives of others, I don't think that that's healthy, and I don't think social media in that respect is our friend. I also think the third issue is that as the line between screen time and bedtime continues to blur, sleep does suffer. And I have seen good data now that 20% of young people are waking up during the night simply to check their social media feeds. And I think, you know, you don't have to be a genius to figure out that that will lead to more fatigue. It's going to decrease school performance and increase irritability. The last two issues relate obviously to body image. And we know that there are studies that have shown simply by spending time on Facebook and Instagram, young people will express a much kind of heightened desire to change their appearance and to self-objectify. And finally, obviously, you know, you've got a situation where 1 in 5 young people are cyberbullied, and that the short, medium, and long-term impacts of those are simply devastating, and include depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, self-harm, and of course, as we saw in January this year, sometimes even suicide.
Yeah, thank you for that, Michael, and we look forward to speaking with you further tonight. So before we launch into Ellie and Michael's presentations tonight, just a reminder about the webinar platform, and just to let you know that the chat box is there, and we really invite your questions through the chat box. After Ellie and Michael's presentations, we will be taking questions from them, and we'll be asking questions from the chat box. So please, we really rely on your questions to make this webinar as worthwhile as possible. Please be respectful of other participants and panellists on the chat box, but we really look forward to your questions. If you do have any technical issues, please click the technical support FAQs tab for help with technical issues. There is a number to call if you need further support. Just to mention that tonight, when we do conclude our webinar, we would love for you to complete the feedback survey, which is loaded under the survey tab at the top of the screen. We've really appreciated through the three webinars we've provided with MHPN this year, the feedback that you've been able to provide us, and that's been able to help us to continually improve the product that we're able to deliver with you each time. So thank you for all of you for that. So learning outcomes for tonight. So through an exploration of developmental psychology on children as they become adolescents, participants will identify tactical tips and strategies for effective conversations with adolescents and parents, recognise the differences between normal adolescent behaviour and mental health conditions such as depression and anxiety, and the participants will describe current trends in adolescent drug and alcohol use, cyberbullying, risk-taking behaviour and self-harm. So, without any further ado, I now we'll reintroduce you to Ellie Robinson, who is going to talk about adolescence from her adolescent health specialist perspective. Thanks, Ellie.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Yeah, and talking about adolescence, as people would well know, anyone who's been in contact with teenagers, that it's this very dynamic period of growth and maturation, both in terms of physical growth, but also social, cognitive and identity development over this time. And we know that it's a terribly risky period for growth and, in fact, the second most risky period in those child and adolescent years after infancy. The way that this period of development goes can impact significantly on what happens within adulthood and outcomes in adulthood, such as academic outcomes and well-being and, of course, mental health in adulthood as well. And you can see the pathways diverge at this age. So it can either go in positive or negative directions. And it's a particularly big fork in the road when this happens. Noticeable changes start to happen in late primary school, and that's, again, going back to the way that we think about the teenage years. It's when you start to hear those negative stories of parents looking forward to these years about as much as they do their annual tax returns and things like that. So the general way that we talk about and think about parenting in those years, even though there's so much positive development going on, they're seeking opportunities to increase independence, changes in peer and family relationships, and the physical changes that are occurring through puberty. It's an incredibly impressive time of growth, but we tend to talk so negatively about it and not look forward to it. You can see how these changes are reflected in the case study that we were presented with for this talk, how the changing relationship is happening between Kelly and Grace, the daughter, that Kelly doesn't really know how to deal with Grace's behaviour and really doesn't have that developmental perspective around it, whereas Grace is pining for the old days and the way that she used to be close to her mum. And both of them have their own way of reflecting about things as they were. And then you can see Lockie as being the still perfect child. We often traditionally have talked about the adolescent years as being four worlds of adolescence, which are peers, individual, school and family. But of course, there's now this fifth world that is so instrumental in young people's lives, which is technology. And Grace is a member of this increasingly vulnerable age group that we think of just at that really transitional age between the pre-teenage years and the teenage years. So we have Sigmund Freud to thank for thinking about it as the latent years, but we now know that there's a lot happening in those years leading up to the teenager period. So, for example, we know that puberty happens, the actual changes start to happen around 7 or 8 years. It's just that we don't necessarily see those changes quite as clearly as we do once they move into the teenage years. And alongside the changes that puberty brings, we transition young people from a quite close knit, one teacher, small classroom sizes often in a primary school to a secondary school education setting where suddenly they are in a much bigger setting with different people. The year six wobbles where friendships started to break down a little bit have been broken up and often they've been at different schools. So a lot happening in that school transition period, and we know that school connectedness has a very strong link to anxiety and depression in the teenage years. So maintaining that connectedness across those years and transitioning also from families having involvement with school to much less involvement in the senior school years are big changes for young people. And then on top of this, we have the influx of social media. And you can hear how Kelly and Grace talk about the use of Facebook and how that's affected their, also how they perceive that's affected their relationships. So this is a key window of opportunity at this time for both parents and professionals to build that developmental understanding of the preteen and early teenage years. This slide I really like because it shows quite clearly how since the Industrial Revolution roughly 200 years ago, where first menarche for young women and psychosocial maturation happened at around about the same time. There wasn't this mismatch that we now see when we look at present-day development that really clearly shows where the age of puberty has lowered from 100 years ago being 16 years of age now to around about 13 years of age. That's plateaued a little bit now, and a lot of those The reasons why it has reduced so much are put down to things like diet and vaccination that has helped with infections. So much lower rates of puberty, but also what we've seen is that psychosocial transitions are happening so much later. So we know that marriage happens later, having first children happens later, and that young people are much more likely to be at home for longer. So in the 1970s, it would only be 1 in 5 young people aged between 18 and 35 who would still be at home. Now it's 1 in 3. So these changing relationships between young people in the home while they're in their adult years and with their parents is an area that's not discussed very much, but much more common these days. The other thing that has become apparent, very much so from research in the last decade or so, is that we know that the adolescent brain goes through this developmental period right up until the mid-20s. So the areas of the prefrontal cortex develop in the final years of that development, and they're the areas that are responsible for things like impulse control and good decision-making and understanding the consequences of behaviour. So it's a really good thing for parents and professionals to understand that that part of the brain is often not fully developed in young people yet, and that we have to maintain that part for them a little bit longer. The good news is that the adolescent brain is very malleable. So in terms of learning new skills and absorbing new information, it's a really good time for that to happen. The adolescent brain is very open to these new experiences. So opening up possibilities in terms of sport, art, drama, learning a new language, all those sorts of things the adolescent brain is very primed for. The downside of that, of course, is that at this time, the brain is so much more vulnerable to chemical and hormonal damage. The family environment in these years plays a very undervalued role. So often we think of these years as meaning that young people start to hang out with peers more and they're less interested in family and this conflict starts to happen. But what we know is that even though peers become more important in these years, parenting is still really important, and particularly around the big decision making in terms of things like career or culture and the way that young people think about what they're going to do when they grow up, whereas peers play much more of a role in day-to-day social activities and so forth. So we don't want parents to check out too early in this time. We really want them to hang in there and play a strong parenting role and be that part of their young person's brain while they're still growing. Those accepting and supportive family relationships in adolescence are really important for healthy functioning, even into adulthood. So we see within this period of development for Grace that Kelly really needs to step up and get that perspective of being a parent to Grace and to be to understand her and where she's coming from, because she's so at risk with her behaviours at the moment. In terms of the things that she is at risk for, and what we need to ask whether we can intervene early in this year, are some of the following stats. So we know that 1 in 3 12 to 25-year-olds self-report high or very high psychological distress. That's from the Mission Australia Youth Survey that they put out every year. Bullying is most common at these years, so late primary and early high school year. We know from the longitudinal study of Australian children that 1 in 3 10 to 11-year-olds experience bullying. Often the most likely thing is name calling, and of course the girls are more involved in covert bullying, whereas boys are often involved in more physical bullying. And of course, as Michael mentioned, we now have cyberbullying, which takes it into a different realm again, very much 24/7, whereas it often used to be in and around the school time. 1 in 8 12 to 17-year-olds report a mental health problem. That's from the Young Minds Matter survey, which was with 6,000 families in 2013 and 2014. So very strong data that says that this is very common for young people to report a mental health problem. 1 in 10, 14 and 15-year-olds self-harmed in the previous 12 months, very high, much higher in young women. Again, that's from the longitudinal data, so a good strong data set. The good news is that a study from Deakin University by John Turnbury showed that alcohol use is actually declining, and it's not being replaced by other drugs that has often been what's happened. We know that the age of first use has risen in 1999 from 14 years of age to 2015, where it was 16 years of age. So that's the good news. But of course, we still know that there are risky groups within that, and particularly with the impulse, the lack of impulse control, that young people tend to find themselves in risky behaviours, especially when their peer groups are engaging in that. So I'll hand over to Michael. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Ellie. Really appreciated some of that research, and I think as you were talking, I was really mindful of Grace, our 13-year-old star of our case study, and all of that going on for her, also within the mix of the issues that she's also facing with friends on social media and at home. So, yeah, that really brought some of that into focus. So thank you. That was great. I'll now hand over to Michael to talk about that from a psychologist's perspective. Michael.
Thank you, Dan. So from my point of view, one of the things that we always sort of have to look for is what helps young people thrive under those very difficult circumstances that Ali has described. There's no doubt that the journey from childhood to young adulthood in 2018 certainly seems to be fraught with more difficulty perhaps now than it has been for a while. So what are the sort of characteristics I look for as a psychologist? And essentially, they're five. The first is I really feel a great sense of relief when the young person tells me on questioning that they have someone in their life. I call them a charismatic adult, someone from whom they can draw strength, someone who makes them feel three things: safe, valued, and listened to. And if I've got that, that really gives me a great sense of security. The second is what my old friend Steve Bidolf used to call a spark. Earlier researchers referred to it as the islands of confidence. And this is having something, if you like, that gets them up in the morning, something they're really good at. Ellie mentioned earlier, you know, art, music, dance, drama, sport, something that they have chosen to do and that they can persist at and see the value of associating effort with outcome. I think this is really important, a good sign, good prognostic sign. Secondly, obviously, emotionally intelligent, the ability to read social situations. We're really talking here about social and emotional competencies. And I was at a bullying conference in New South Wales last week, and, you know, clearly the research is very, very firm now that if we can teach young people skills like conflict resolution, anger management, problem solving, decision making, we can really do a great deal to help them cope with and manage what happens at school. So having that, another big tick. The fourth is this sense of meaning, purpose, and belonging, a feeling of being connected to something or someone that transcends the material world, something really that makes them feel like they're part of something bigger than themselves. And I'm not necessarily here talking about religiosity, although there's nothing wrong with that, or even spirituality, you know, belonging to, for example, a football team, belonging to some sort of environmental movement or a political movement. I think all of these things are really powerful predictors of resilience. And lastly, that positive self-talk, this idea that almost every single young person is tuned into almost their own radio station, Michael FM. And what Michael says to Michael every day actually does determine not just how he sees the world, but how he thinks and how he feels and also how he behaves. So if we can have a flexible self-talk, if we can have a degree of recognition when one catastrophizes or lives by really fixed rules, that I think is incredibly useful and very helpful. The other thing is clearly relevant in this Grace Kelly dynamic is you have to actually be able to communicate effectively with young people. And one of the most important things is literally to disconnect from your technology. It's so interesting to see all the research now that has quite young children complaining on a regular basis about how their parents are never off their phone. The other thing, if you're going to have a conversation, you really got to think about the place, and neutral is great. So cafes, parks. The great thing about driving in the car is that they can't get out because you're going 100, but you kind of got a captured audience, but you also don't have to look them straight in the face. So I'm very big on the car talk. And it's pretty important if you decide to have a conversation with the young person that you better check that they're in the right mood and that you're in the right frame of mind, because that they're very good at picking up tone and facial expression. So you need to be a bit chipper, a bit up. And the other thing is, get to the point. Do not go on and on and on. And it's really important. One of my principles in working with young people is to tell them what I'm going to tell them, and then tell them what I've told them, using really concrete images and paying very close attention to the fact that I'm getting the message across, and perhaps even seeking on occasion some clarification that the message has got through. And also, look, it's quite important to be a bit of a student of teen culture and actually know what you're talking about, because otherwise you may in fact be written off as a bit of an antique. And even though I'm pretty old, I still manage to keep up to date with what the young people tell me. And I think it's great because they actually inform me. And the other thing for all parents is to really choose your battleground. You know, no one's ever died of an untidy room. Seriously, shut the door, walk away. Remember a few years ago, there was a mother who I saw who was just absolutely obsessed with the fact that her daughter's room was untidy. And I did actually get her to take a photograph of the room when it was pristine, take that down to Officeworks and get it blown up to door size. And we just stuck it on the front of her door so that every single time she walked past her daughter's room, it was immaculate. So one of the things that we do have to ask ourselves is, well, when should we really worry? And I think there are four key issues which I want everybody to be aware of. We know that at no other time in their lives is the desire to be with their age mates so strong. So if you get this kind of unexpected withdrawal from peers, that's actually something that warrants investigation big time. The second is a sustained decline in academic performance. That can very often indicate depressive illness. And what you find is that young person can no longer concentrate and focus on anything, let alone school. But that's a really good sign, because you've got basically a before and an after. If you have a young person who is a bit moody, that can be fairly normal. But if you get 2 to 3 weeks of low mood where they're no longer interested in the things that used to interest them, you have sleep and appetite disturbance, that they seem very negative, hopeless, helpless, withdrawn, these things are really, really important. Now, remember that depression is quite common in young people. What is often not understood is people expect young people to be really sad and miserable the whole time. Quite often it can show itself in irritability. So that's what we need to look for in working with young people. In this particular case study, which I thought was very good, and congratulations to the people who developed it, the bottom line is that mum, as Ellie mentioned earlier, completely lacks a developmental perspective. We have to remember that young people do have 100 billion brain cells, 1,000 trillion connections, and when watered, fed and rested, it will generate, you know, 20 watts of electricity, and the messages in the brain will go up 421K an hour. But what we have to recognize is they're not all wired up. And as Ellie mentioned in her piece, you won't in fact get wired up till the mid-20s. And during that time, a unique characteristic of young people is an inability to predict the consequences of their actions. So look, I think we've got to pay attention to communicating really clearly with that developmental perspective, cutting them some slack, and not demonizing young people for their developmental stage. You know, Lockie is regarded clearly as the angel child, and of course he is, because he hasn't developed that sort of adolescent brain, remembering that one of the things you do in adolescence is break away from the bonds that bound you to your adult carer. You are literally trying to break free from the gravitational pull of planet parent, and you want independence and you want autonomy. From this case, Gracie is just simply not tackling the key developmental tasks I'd look for in someone her age. And I'm a bit worried about her. I think she is at risk for depression. I think that her peer contacts are not optimal. I don't think she's yet figured out the answer to the question, well, who am I? Because she's not taking those sort of healthy risks that she needs to. And she's really struggling with emancipation from mum. And I think that her connection with school is pretty dodgy as well. So by and large, this would be a kid that I would enjoy seeing. And I think it would be useful for her to reflect on what's going on. One of the things about these types of kids is they hold their problems very close to their chest. They don't share. They find it very difficult to take another perspective. So that would be the role of a caring and good psychologist. From the risk and protective factor framework, and Ellie talked about the five world models. So each one of those five worlds, when we do our formulation, we look at the risks and protective factors in each of those worlds. Look, she's got lots. She's got a really strained relationship with mum, where neither party are really enjoying it very much. The peers are not pro-social. And by pro-social, I mean doing the sorts of things that we want kids to do, the, you know, art, music, dance, drama, sports stuff. I don't think she's got very good coping skills. Part of that is developmental, but also I don't think anybody's actually sat down with her and had a discussion about better ways of coping. She's certainly not engaged in school, and that is a problem because, as Ellie pointed out in her opening piece, that school connectedness can be a major protective factor, almost as an anchor as they break away from mum and dad. And she certainly doesn't have a spark, no island of competence. And the most startling thing about her is her rigidity of self-talk. And if you have that rigidity of self-talk, you're going to have really fixed ways of going about approaching the world, and you're going to get upset when things don't go the way you want, and that's never good. So a little bit of cognitive behavioral therapy, perhaps using some of the resources that we talk about later on. There's an excellent book by Sarah Edelman called Good Thinking. There's an app called Mood Kit, and there's a whole range of excellent online programs like eCouch and Mood Gym that I just think are fantastic, which would really help augment my therapy with her. So what would I do with this family? Look, I'd probably do some family therapy, certainly to help Grace and Kelly connect, look at some of the family of origin issues, and I'd also probably recommend that mum does the Triple P parenting program. I think it's the best current program available in Australia. I think it's got, I don't think, I know it's got a really good evidence base and well worthwhile. With her, I would do both cognitive behavioral therapy and probably a little bit of interpersonal therapy to help her communicate a bit more clearly with the people around her. I'd also try and see if we could get a regular family ritual. We know from the research that building strong families is all about having a sense of us-ness, a sense of we-ness, something that we do on a regular basis. And at the moment, going on the basis of what we know about this case, it doesn't seem to be any regular family ritual. And I think Gracie's kind of crying out for one, so maybe we could invoke one. And of course, I'd like to involve the whole school welfare team, year level coordinators, maybe if there's a student welfare person, just to see whether or not we could all get on the same page in helping this this lovely young woman. Over to you, Dan.
Thank you, Michael. So as you've been speaking, we've had some questions, one from Murphy in particular, around How do we promote this possibility of positive parenting with teenagers to parents? And I was interested in your work with someone like Kelly. How do you engage with her in a way that looks at Grace's social and emotional wellbeing, but at the same time is not stigmatising or shaming the parents?
Look, I think it's, first of all, being really understanding that this is probably one of the first generations of Australian parents who've actually had to raise parents in a complete vacuum. See, we've had to move to get jobs, and in moving to get jobs geographically, we've actually destroyed almost most of the kinship networks. And I think those kinship networks afforded a great deal of experience and help and support to parents. So I think a lot of parents are really struggling, and I would be acknowledging that up front. The second thing I would be doing is giving her very gently a crash course in the developmental psychology of adolescence, acknowledging her frustration. One of the things that I love doing now is their videos. There's, as I said, the Triple P parenting course. There's some excellent books written by Ellie Robinson and myself that I would probably be sharing with her as well. So it really is a sympathetic, understanding, caring, but informative and quite directive approach. If she continues to do things that I think are not in her interest, I'm old enough now and ugly enough now to be really quite directive. I think as a younger psychologist, I was probably less quick. But now I will be really, really clear and supportive, but I will be very clear about what needs to happen.
Thank you, Michael. That's a great answer. Ellie, I've got numerous questions here after your presentation around this issue of computer games and screen times. And I think professionals and parents, count myself amongst one of them, really wanting to know is, like, what is the effect for particularly boys as they reach the teenage years on playing computer games? Some of these games can be violent. What sort of effects does this have on them, and how much of it should they be doing?
Yeah, I think it's important to start with saying that we really demonise technology. We have this blanket fear when it comes to teenagers and technology. We have a blanket fear of teenagers anyway, then you add another blanket fear on top. So you can see how parents really don't know what to do when they get into this period where young people don't really discriminate between the online and offline world like we often do. It's all one world to them. But there's a lot of creativity that happens online. There's a lot of communication with friends and family. So we need to be moderate in the way that we think about it. So and to set boundaries in the same way that we would with other behaviours with children. So sometimes I think what we don't know, we have less experience in setting, and we haven't had parents who have helped us to understand how to do that. So setting boundaries around involvement in other activities, turning off the Wi-Fi, setting limits to time online are really all skills that you would do for other activities that you can bring to the table for technology use as well. When to worry around playing games, I think some of the really key points that are good to look for are things like if your child can't let go of that game time, if they crave more all the time, if they are suffering from migraines or chronic dry eyes, those sorts of physical examples, if they are not being truthful about how much they're online, or they're hiding the iPad under their pillow and you find it at night, clearly that's not a great thing either, or if they become irritable. And I think one of the things with online gaming in particular to look out for is if your young person is playing a multiplayer game where they're expected to be part of the game and to keep that team going all of the time, places a lot of stress on young people to be aware and be online all the time to do that. If parents have a look online, there's some really great support groups. The problem kind of has a solution in it as well. And there are groups online that talk about the ways that they have overcome some of those addictions around games like World of Warcraft is one of them, where there's a strong online support group, and I'm sure there's others as well. So, yeah, take a look around online and see what's there.
Thanks, Ali. That's a really great answer. Michael, a question for you. We've got quite a few questions here talking about, in particular, teenagers who are going through adverse experiences. So Elliot, for example, asked about what are teenagers who are going through sexual abuse. We've got other questions around teenagers who are going through mental health issues and withdrawal from family and others. So when you're working with a young person who's had one or multiple adversities in their lives, what is it that you're looking to do to work with them in a positive way?
I always default to a sort of loss and grief model, because all of these represent little losses in the lives, sometimes very big losses in the lives of young people. And I wrote my PhD sitting on a child and adolescent cancer ward at the Prince of Wales Children's Hospital back in the olden days. And I spent literally 4 years sitting talking to a bunch of young people who were dying and or struggling to live with their cancer. And I always look at, I try and look at those four worlds ostensibly. How is or how has what is happening to this young person impacted on themselves, their family, their peers, and of course their schooling? And so I believe that if you can look at those four worlds and you can identify the problems, the risk factors in those areas, and you can identify some positives, the formulation about how you work with them is really based on what you find out from your discussion with them. I've always been a great fan of the HEADS screening tool, which Headspace have on their website, which was invented originally by Goldenring and Cohen, who were two psychologists who wrote in a journal called Contemporary Pediatrics back in 1988, a long time ago. This has been reworked a number of times, and it basically goes through their home, their education, their activities, whether or not they're doing drugs, they're depressed, sexuality, spirituality, suicidal ideation. And I've always, obviously, after been doing it for 30 years, you just do it instinctively. So you're having a conversation with a young person, but in the back of your mind the whole time, you've got these four worlds and you're trying to populate them with kids who've suffered great loss, great hardship. You'll always find that their areas of deficit, and they're all different for every kid. So in your formulation, you're trying to decrease the risk factors and increase the positives. With respect to the loss and grief model, I was trained by a great guy called Mal McKissick in New South Wales many, many years ago. And the thing that Mal always said is that the one way to get through loss and grief and pain is to talk about it, and to have someone who will just listen and then feed back to the young person precisely what it is that they've said, perhaps not in the exact same words, but in different words. I think that's a really, really good way to help young people overcome their pain. Sometimes you've got multiple pain, and sometimes it takes a long time, but it's still worth the effort.
Yeah, thank you very much, Michael. Ellie, a question from Courtney for you is, she's asked a question with all we know about mental health now in modern professions, how can we distinguish between what we know about the experiences of mental health, but also what we know about the developmental hormones that are occurring for teenagers at this time? How do we distinguish between those two issues, and how do we have conversations with our teenagers to get their perspective on what they think?
That's a great question. I'll do that one. A great question around developmental hormones. And that we've really been sold that idea that the adolescent years are about storm and stress. So a lot of parents and professionals believe that that's a natural part of being a teenager, is that we will see these changes in mood all the time. So it's really important to have that idea about what is or normal or natural changes during those adolescent years, and what we really need to look out for as signs of when we need to worry. And I think some of the things that Michael was talking about in his talk around, if there is a irritable or depressed mood, you might get that for a day or two, or where things have not been so great for that teenager on that day. But if it's persistent for a period of time, then you'll know to keep an eye on that and to make sure that you go and see a GP or see someone and talk about what the issues are. Important to keep those lines of communication open. I can't tell you how many of my daughter's parents, I'm just amazed that the lack of communication and understanding they have about their own children, and how that feeds into them not being able to really understand the different ways that their own child responds to things, and when you might be looking at something that you need to have that conversation with them, or have a significant other adult in their life if they don't want to talk to you, but always being available in the background and having that routine behind them so that they know that when they're ready to come to you or to someone else, that they can talk about that, or you can take them to a professional to be able to talk about what's going on for them.
Thanks, Ellie. Great answers and some really great questions coming through from you. We've got about 700 people logged into this webinar at the moment, and some great questions coming, so please keep them coming. We'll endeavour to get through as many of them as we can in the next 20 minutes or so. Michael, a question from you, and it's really picking up on what you said around your directive approach that you might take with the parent. Does this directive approach sometimes transfer to your work with adolescents? Or do you spend a bit more time building rapport and a therapeutic alliance with teens? There's a question from Jane.
It's a great question. Look, the single most important thing in working with young people is rapport. And in order to gain rapport, there are a couple of things that I always do. And one is I clearly outline the confidentiality, because I don't think that's really well understood by them. So they need to know that nothing that they will say to me will be revealed to other people unless it looks as if someone's hurting them, they're going to hurt someone else, or they're going to hurt themselves. And I think it's really important that you do that. Then I ask questions which actually are about trying to find out about the person. I try not to take a sort of deficit approach straight off. I really try to find out what their perception of the situation is, and really go out of my way to build trust and rapport, because I don't think you can do anything without that. Once you've done that, then you can begin to ask those questions. The beautiful thing about the HEDS model, and I hate to go back to it, but it's really beautiful, is that it starts off with, you know, some really general, gentle questions. And I think that that allows, after a while, as the trust builds, for you to move into the more personal stuff. You know, when you're talking to people about their sexuality, when you're talking about drugs, or maybe, you know, if you really get a sense that they're feeling pretty lousy, you know, the sort of approach that I will take with them is say, look, I've been sitting here for a while and really respect what you've said, but I can't help wondering, with everything on your plate at the moment, I wonder whether you've actually thought from time to time about hurting yourself or perhaps even not being here. So that's the sort of gentle approach that I've been taught over the years by some very, very good role models, notably John Court, who Ali and I worked with, and Dr. Michael Schwartz. And I think, you know, you just pick up the right way to do it. And, you know, most often the young people respond really well. They have, I think, an inbuilt bull dust detector, so that if you try and snow them, they'll pick you up. But there is certainly a time often will come where you have to be reasonably directive. But if you start there, you're going to come a cropper. You have to build trust first.
Thanks, Michael. Ellie, a question for you. Alton asks, how can professionals help parents who are feeling anxious about their teenagers? They're wanting to be supportive of teenagers as they go through, you know, some tough times, but at the same time, they might need to be giving their teenagers some space. What sort of research or ideas might you be able to add to that kind of dilemma?
Yeah, look, there's an amazing array of help out there to understand how to deal with the teenage years, and particularly at different stages. So I think it's important to say that, like we see in the 0 to 5 year old age group, over 13 to 18, there's just this amazing amount of change that goes on, and your child's needs will differ throughout those ages. So trying to find that balance between giving them enough freedom to be able to test the boundaries, and they will take risks and push those boundaries, because that's what they're programmed to do. They need to be able to give them that opportunity, because in the end, when they're adults, they're going to need to be able to go out in the world and deal with what they come up against. So we can't wrap them in cotton wool. We need to give teenagers the opportunity to experience things, but not so far that they it goes beyond their ability to cope at whatever their age level is. And finding that balance is really quite hard. But again, encouraging parents to tap into the really good resources that are out there. There's some resources that we've put on the list that's available after tonight's webinar, places like raisingchildren.net.au, the Beyond Blue Healthy Family site, which are really great for parents to be able to go. They can chat on forums and hear about others' experience, talk to other parents about their experiences in raising teenagers, and really try and look for the good in these years. There's amazing growth that goes on, as I mentioned before. So smile at teenagers, engage with them, have conversations, ask them about their day. Sometimes you'll get the grunting good, but other times they'll open up. And it's about being available when your teenager comes to you and wants to talk to you. As Michael said before, put down the phone. And he's right in saying that we know from research that it's often children who are saying, I really want to talk to mum or dad, but they're constantly on their phone all the time and I just can't contact them at all. So opening up those spaces to be able to talk to your child when they really come to you and want to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you, Ellie. Really good point there too. Ellie mentioned that there are some supporting resources as part of this webinar available to you as audience members. You can access these through the supporting resources tab at the bottom of the screen. So there's some wonderful resources there, both through Emerging Minds and other sources. I think Michael and Ellie might have even given their books a plug in there, which might also be really worth considering. So, Michael, a question for you, and this question comes from Martek, who's asked, in terms of the social media interests for kids in Australia, in terms of the trends around that, is that kind of worrying when we look at that in comparison to other countries like throughout Europe or America, or is the experience of the typical Australian child fairly kind of common with those worldwide at the moment?
Great question. It seems to be pretty much a developmental phase that almost the whole world teenagers are going through, certainly the Western world. I'm currently conducting an inquiry on behalf of the New South Wales Department of Education on the use, for example, of mobile phones in schools. This is particularly at recess and at lunchtime and during the classroom. And I just had the privilege of meeting with five distinguished professors from around the world that the New South Wales Department of Education brought together. And it's universal. There is no question that this is, you know, they're screen agers. They love their screens. And I think that the implications for parents are huge. It is really important that we set screen time limits. It's really helpful to have family media plans that include a screen time for each and every child. The research seems to show that if you set limits, that will help to set children's expectations. And the research shows that when parents set these limits, there's a significant reduction in their overall screen time. Of course, successful implementation requires consistency over time. And you know, you've got to practice what you preach, you've got to enforce the rules. And I'm very big on using technology like, for example, Family Zone. It's a neat little, I don't know if you're familiar with this, this is a program. You can actually put the app on each of the kids' devices, and it enables you to control virtually every aspect of what particular programs they're accessing, how long they're on for, when it switches off and goes to bed. And if the kids try and remove it, it renders the phone a useless piece of plastic. There's something kind of beautiful about that. Now, that might sound harsh, but what you have to understand is that Australia is currently facing a sleep deprivation pandemic. Professor Mary Cuskaden from Brown University did the early research on this, and she said, look, adolescents need 9 hours. Well, I went to a school in Horsham recently that did something very clever. They put a whole lot of Fitbits on the year nines, and the Fitbits actually track sleep. And they found that in this particular institution, the kids were averaging about 5.5 hours a night. Well, that's just not okay. That's not good for their psychological development. It's not good for their physiological development. So there are very real issues around this. And while the mobile phone inquiry is yet to reach its conclusion, we'll do that in December, it's interesting how many parents and how many teachers have really expressed not just a little bit of concern, but great concern over the impact that this has, not only on socialization skills, but also on sleep and the mental health of many of these young people. So that was a great question.
Thanks, Michael. Ellie, question for you. There's some questions coming through regarding the role of high schools in, or primary schools for that matter as well, in helping with the messages that young people approaching and in adolescence both convey to each other but also receive themselves. What can you tell us about some of the things that schools are thinking about and doing in response to this?
Yeah, again, a good question. And it's important to encourage parents to understand the way that primary schools approach the transition period for those later years of primary school and how they support parents in that knowledge about what children need at that time and what they will need when they make that transition. As I mentioned in the talk, that transition time we know now is incredibly important and happens at the same time as a number of other challenges for young people. So understanding how schools deal, particularly with the year six or in some states year seven year, when kids start to get a bit anxious, the friendships start to crumble a little bit, they're not as close-knit as they were, relationships with the same sex or opposite sex relationships start to come to the fore. So really understanding that time and having a school that does a really great job, and often they do, around supporting parents to understand that transition, doing some really good rituals around the end of the school year and orienting young people to the first year of high school, they're the really important things to be looking for in terms of the ways that the schools and parents by association deal with that time.
Yeah, thanks, Ellie. Question for Michael from Ruth. Ruth asks, when does a parent have a right to know what is happening in their adolescent child's life? So for you, Michael, what are the ethics in deciding when you're working with a teenager and possibly their parent or parents? How do you make decisions about which information you might provide parents? Or if an adolescent, for example, asks you to withhold information, when and how might you do that?
It's a really easy question to answer, and it's to do with safety. And that is, if I feel that the young person is in danger, physical, psychological danger, then confidentiality goes out the window. And I've made that really clear to them. My practice is not only to tell them, but also to, for example, get them to download the confidentiality fact sheet from reachout.com, one of the most excellent websites, or even the websites on confidentiality for the Headspace. So they're clear right up front what the limits of confidentiality is, and if they tell me something that basically I feel is endangering their lives, then confidentiality goes out the window.
Okay. Just on safety, Michael, Mia and Eleanor and others have actually asked the question about what do we do when a young person tells us that they want to, or that they actually are hurting themselves, or perhaps they're even considering ending their life?
Well, those are two quite separate issues. Self-harm is very common in young people. So that would be an issue around perhaps helping them to develop some coping mechanisms. About 17% of the children or the adolescents who self-harm will go on to serious suicidal ideation. So it's a quite low number. But certainly if a young person tells me that they're thinking of taking their own life, then I will do a full suicide assessment. I will do a safety plan. And there's a rather excellent app which I can recommend to everybody, developed by Beyond Blue, called Beyond Now, which is a digital safety plan which all of my clients would fill in under those circumstances. And it's pretty self-explanatory. It basically lays out the parameters of how the young person can keep themselves safe, and if life becomes too difficult, what they can do about it.
Thanks, Michael. And thanks, Michael and Ellie, for answering those questions. There are many more questions rolling in, and we really appreciate the activity in the chat box this evening. Some really sophisticated and intelligent questions from you. So thank you very much, and well answered as well, I must say, from Ellie and Michael. So before we reach the concluding stages of tonight's webinar, I'll just invite Ellie and Michael just maybe to spend a minute each just summing up any kind of last-minute thoughts or your impressions of tonight's webinar. So I might start with you, Ellie, if that's okay.
Sure. Thanks, Dan. And again, thanks to all of you for some really great questions there. And I think it shows how much of an important time this is for people to understand that developmental perspective and help young people to launch into those teenage years in a really positive way. The interface between parents, schools, other significant adults, everything else that a young person engages with is incredibly important. And the more that we can help those areas to gain the skills and the confidence in understanding young people and helping them to develop in a really positive way is important. So I really encourage people to make an effort to engage in those conversations positively, talk about young people in a positive way, look at the resources and the different tools that are available to help to launch young people into a good space during those years, because it's incredibly important. They're our next wave of adults and parents, and so we need to be able to understand and help them to develop in a really positive way.
Thanks, Ellie. And Michael, some final thoughts?
Thanks, Dan. I think the most important thing is to bear in mind the models that we've given you today, the key developmental tasks. If a young person is travelling okay, they will in fact be asking the question, who am I? They will in fact be emancipating from their mum and dad. They will have good peer relationships and they will have a reasonable relationship with school. That's pivotal. In terms of building resilience, got to make sure they have that charismatic adult. That's so important. Make sure they have that spark, that good self-talk. Make sure that in terms of everything that they do, they have a sense of meaning and purpose and belonging. And if you can kind of use that as your guiding light, it was the great parenting expert, Maggie Beer, who once said that young people need lighthouses. And I actually agree, a beacon of adulthood that can light the way, particularly when they're emancipating from their mum or their dad.
Thank you, Michael. And maybe just one last question for you, Ellie. For those of you who, for those people out there who have enjoyed listening to you and Michael tonight and perhaps might like to know more, can you just maybe let us know about the series of books that the two of you have co-authored?
Yeah, sure. So Michael's a far more prolific author than I am, but we've teamed up in the past couple of years to write an update of Michael's classic Princess Bitch Face Syndrome. This one is 2.0. We've written the boy book, which I know a lot of people have been waiting for some time, which is Prince Bullhead Syndrome. And the most recent book that we've published, which was only a couple of months ago, is an update of Surviving Adolescence, again, 2.0. So across those books, there's some really great skills, knowledge and strategies for people to use working with adolescents.
Thank you, Ellie, and thank you, Michael, again. That's been a really worthwhile and interesting webinar. So thank you both for your time.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Michael. Pleasure.
Okay, so as we said before, resources and further reading are available at the Supporting Resources tab at the bottom of your screen. And also for more information about children's mental health, please contact us and visit our website at Emerging Minds at www.emergingminds.com.au. Before you leave tonight, also just a quick reminder, please take the time to fill in the feedback survey form for us. As I said before, we really appreciate the feedback that we get from you throughout this entire MHPN and Emerging Minds webinar series, and it really does help to make sure that we're constantly evolving and making the product that will provide you better and more useful for you. So thank you everyone for participating tonight. I feel like that the number of responses and questions and comments that we got throughout the chat box was extremely useful, and we were able to ask our presenters mostly questions that came from you. So that was really enjoyable, and got some great responses from them. So thanks for joining us. As I said, please complete the feedback survey. Just also to let you know that certificates of attendance for this webinar will be issued within 4 weeks, so look out for those. Each participant that's been online tonight will be sent a link to the online resources associated with this webinar within about 2 weeks. And as I said before, please look out for the next webinar in the Emerging Minds and MHBN webinar series. That will be Supporting Children's Mental Health After Trauma. And that will happen in about February of 2019. Also, please look out for the final BPD webinar on Management in Public Mental Health Services, Public and Private Healthcare Sectors. That'll be held through MHPN on Monday the 26th of November. So MHPN, the next webinar will be on psychological treatments for trichotillomania, if I pronounce that right, on Thursday the 6th of December. And please visit the MHPN website, mhpn.org.au, for more info and for registration. So this webinar was co-produced by MHPN and Emerging Minds for the Emerging Minds National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health Project. The project is led by Emerging Minds and delivered in partnership with the Australian Institute of Family Studies, the Australian National University, the Parenting Research Centre and the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. The project is funded by the Australian Government Department of Health under the National Support for Child and Youth Mental Health Support Program. So thank you. And before I close, I'd just like to acknowledge the consumers and the carers who have lived with mental illness in the past and those who continue to live with mental illness in the present. Thank you to everyone for your participation, and we look forward to meeting with you again. Thank you.